Welcome to the Level Playing Field podcast with your host, David Yu, the platform where aviation and finances meet. Each week, David will be interviewing guests from all different careers in aviation who can help us explore how each career impacts a family's personal finances and lifestyle. Now, here's your host, David Yu.
Welcome. I'm David Yu, Certified Financial Planner Practitioner and host of the Level Playing Field podcast. This week, I interview Seth Kolesinski. He's currently a captain of Delta Airlines and through his career has flown the Boeing 727, 757, 767, 717, 737, and the MD-80. Join us as he talks about his love for aviation and the challenges he faced through the 2001 and 2008 recessions. To find out more about my aviation-related podcast and blog, please check out www.thelevelplainfield.com. That's the level, P-L-A-N-E, field.com. If you have any financial questions, consult your attorney, accountant, or financial advisor. If you're interested in how I help airline pilots as a certified financial planner practitioner, please visit www.pacunited.com. That's P-A-C-United.com. Welcome, Seth, to the Level Playing Field podcast. Glad to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, cool. So let's talk about your experience a little bit. You know, Seth Kolesinski. Who is Seth Kolesinski? And tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm basically just a kid that loves to fly. Since I can remember, for whatever reason, loved airplanes, loved flying. And at some point in my teenage years, I guess, I realized that I could actually make a living flying airplanes. So I figured, all right, got to have a job when I'm older. That's what I'm going to do. I didn't know any pilots growing up, definitely no airline pilots. So I didn't really understand how to get in the business, how to go about doing it, kind of figured out for myself, for better or for worse. My analogy is I was basically standing at the base of a mountain, looking at the top, thinking, you know, I want to stand on top of that.
Yeah.
How do I get it? So as most people probably know, maybe they don't, there's no one way to get to the top of the mountain. There's no path up, single path up the mountain. There's a lot of different routes you can take, you know, military, civilian, or whatever. So I'll tell you my story, you know, as a civilian guy.
Yeah, that'd be great.
This isn't the only path to that goal. Yeah, so anyways, here I'm a kid. I want to go fly for the airlines. How do I do it? My parents recognized that flying was my thing. I used to build model airplanes. Matter of fact, I started out building these little remote, I don't know if you remember those balsa wood airplanes, you know, with the little engines okay. Stick on the front of them. Yeah, so I figured out how to build those things, take them out to the schoolyard. Basically taught myself how to fly. I go out there the first day, throw it about 10 feet, it crashes into a bunch of little pieces. I take it home, rebuild it. Next time, it goes 20 feet, take it back home, rebuild it, and next thing, you know, after a while, I'm flying this thing. So I was determined. I definitely really wanted to do that.
Yeah, there you go. Persistence, right?
Absolutely. Doesn't matter what you do, man. Persistence pays off, right? So anyways, take it from there. I'm a senior in high school, and my parents are like, you know, you gotta go check out becoming a private pilot. And I was like, yeah, I should. And I did. I went down to Orange County Airport, took a little demo ride, they call them. You probably are familiar with those. You know, you go for like half hour and an assessment and check it out.
Was that John Wayne or was that another airport, Orange County?
That was John Wayne.
John Wayne, right?
John Wayne Airport.
See, they had like airline operations over there at that time, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty crazy place to train then with a bunch of airlines and, you know, just the traffic.
So here's the deal with Orange County Airport, John Wayne, what do you want to call it? It's if you fly out of, say, Chino or wherever you bracket, wherever you're doing, you're going solo in, you know, 35, 40 hours, something like that. At Orange County, it's not going to happen. You're not just learning how to fly the airplane around the paddock. You're learning how to talk, deal with all kinds of jet traffic, airspace. You're learning a lot more by the time you solo than you would be if you're out of Corona.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Pros and cons of that, you know. The downside is it takes you longer, costs you more. But the upside is when you're done, when I got my private pilot out of Orange County, if I wanted to go fly to Brackett Field, piece of cake. There's a guy out of Brackett's going to look at Orange County and go, I don't think I want to go.
Yeah, like, screw that.
Yeah, I'm like, scary. It is. I mean, if you don't know what you're doing, it can be really scary. So anyway, I digress. Yeah, I took a demo ride and I fell in love. I mean, I remember every minute of that ride. I was 18 years old, you know.
Yeah.
I was blown away. So anyways, now it's like, how do I fund it? I was fortunate enough to get a little help from my parents, worked a ton of jobs. And as far as the training goes, I basically kind of slow rolled it through college. I got through all my ratings so that by the time I graduated college, I had my PFI.
Okay.
Instructing for the flight school that I learned through. But yeah, that was my path. I just got to my first paycheck as a pilot, basically. And today it's pretty similar. A lot of people go to universities like Embry-Riddle or I forget, University of North Dakota, whatever. Anyways, they'll...
North Dakota, yeah.
Yeah, they go through their program. And then part of the deal is they usually hire you as a flight instructor afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
You have a job to start with and start building your time. That's the goal of flight instructing. You're not going to get rich off that, obviously. Probably eating top ramen and living on a couch, maybe.
How much would you say you made? Or let's say the average flight instructor. We won't say specifically, but let's say average flight instructor. I mean, how many hours can you... I guess it just depends by school, right? You know, how many hours you can get.
All kinds of variables. So I'll tell you my experience. Mine was, I basically, once I got my flight instructor certificate, got hired, I showed up to the office and sat on the couch and waited for guys to walk in. Whoever wanted a demo ride. Now I'm the demo guy, right? The guy walked in, hey, I'm interested in flying. And I talk him up, and, hey, let's go for a demo ride.
Did you guys get a lot of foot traffic? Like, did that happen frequently? Did you guys get a lot of foot traffic? Like, you know, the people just come in and... Yeah. You're like, hey, looking into flying.
Absolutely. Yeah. Matter of fact, that's pretty much all my clients. I have couch time, we call it. You sit in the couch, you wait for someone to walk in, and you sell them. And and you take them up on a demo flight. You try not to scare them, you know, try to make it fun. And if it all works out, you got a student. And so it takes a while to build your clientele. It took me several months. First couple months, I was hardly doing anything, just demo rides. But after a while, I had a pretty full book. And I was working 6 days a week. You know, I wanted to build time.
Okay.
So I was working, you know, sun up, sun down, sometimes after, as much as I could. Probably flew about 1,000 hours a year.
Okay.
And that's really good. This is mid-90s. I probably made 20-something grand. So definitely wasn't killing it. And honestly, I have no idea what these guys make now. I don't know what their hourly rate is, how much they're flying. I imagine they're flying a fair amount. There seems to be a lot of activity going on. But I want to say... I'm trying to remember how much I got paid an hour back then. You know, again, it's only flight time.
Yeah.
Not the time where you're... I probably got paid between 15 and 20 bucks an hour or something like that.
Oh, maybe. Wow. Okay. From what I've seen, I think it's roughly like 60 to 70 bucks an hour now for flight instruction.
But that's what you're paying, right? That's not what the instructor
is. Oh, yeah, true. Because then the school takes the cut of that, right?
Yeah. So I think our school took about half. And then the longer you were there, you could get a bigger percentage of that or something like that.
Okay. How many hours did you need to get to the airlines at that time? Was it 15 or was it lower?
To get to when you're talking about the regionals, by the time I got to SkyWest, I had 2,500 now.
Okay.
And that wasn't based on FAR limits at all. I don't think back then, I don't believe they were literally like
there were really.
The rules have changed since back then.
Yeah.
For a good, but it was more of supply and demand. You know, you had a certain amount of supply or demand, and then you had enough guys at SkyWest. SkyWest has always been kind of one of the higher ranked regionals, so they could be picky and choosy. You know, they didn't.
Yeah.
If you didn't have hours, like, well, go away. And we got another guy that's got twice the amount of time you have, jet time or whatever, turbine time. Yeah. So nowadays, I know that if you go through a certain program,
mm-hmm.
I'm not the expert on this, but I know, like, Embry-Riddle is one of them. They have certain schools that are certified to allow you to get to a regional airline at lower amounts of hours. It's typically 1,500 now, right? That's the standard.
Yeah, 1,500.
I think you drop it down to 1,000 now if you go through.
Oh, yeah, I've heard that. Yeah, because they're like part 141 or something like that, right?
Yeah, it's even more than 141. My school was 141, but it's not one of the, I don't know the right term for it, but there are certain schools that have a certain, even higher certification. It's 141 plus something else. It's like a college program, basically. That allows you to cut it $500 off your time.
Now, just going through all that stuff, I mean, there's people, let's say they go through Embry-Riddle, they go through the whole program, they probably end up with, what, like, you know, 60, 70 grand of debt, and, you know, stuff like that, you know, just to go through, like, program or whatever, you know, however much, maybe even more. Did you have, like, just from your road to, let's say, private pilots to CFI, did you have to take out any loans? Like, was it hard paying for the lessons? And
yeah, I scrapped. I was doing flight school and college.
Oh, you were doing both. Okay.
Yeah. So, but this, again, this is the early 90s. Things were a lot cheaper back then. College alone is ridiculous, or can be. And so you had tech flight school on top of that, can get pretty pricey. So I did have some student loans, not a lot, but I did have some. I would work as many jobs as I could. Couple of times I had three jobs. I was hustling.
Yeah, well, you got to do what you got to do, right? To
gotta do what you gotta do, man. So
to achieve things.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So And I ended up with a little bit of debt. It wasn't that bad. It was pretty, you know, once I got going, it was pretty easy to pay off.
Yeah. Any interesting / scary instructing experiences? What's your one most scariest experience with the student?
Yeah. So I'll tell you this. So because you're about to solo, don't do this. So at Orange County Airport, back to the original comment of how it can be kind of busy, right? You got a longer runway where the jets land on and a shorter runway that we would traditionally do our pattern work on. So anyways, the program was we go out, do some pattern work with the guy, make sure he's okay or he or she. And then if you, as an instructor, if you felt comfortable, you would have him stop. You say, all right, I'm getting out of the airplane.
Yeah, see ya.
And yeah, we didn't have handheld radio. So once.
So you're just by yourself with ATC. That's it.
Standing by the runway, watching him go around. And he would come by me every time. And I would say yay or nay. If he was fine, he'd keep on. And anyways, he's been solid all the way through. And he goes around 2 times. So it's a great, great couple landings. And give him a thumbs up. He goes around the third time. And on the third time, he lines up on the bigger runway.
Yeah.
And again, I have no radio, so I have no idea what's going on. I assume the tower told him to land on that runway.
Yeah.
Which they've done before to me. I've seen that happen before. Anyway, so he lands on the right runway. But as he's getting ready to land on it, I see a regional turboprop coming up right behind him and go around right over the top.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
I knew I was in trouble. So anyway.
Did tower say anything?
Well, yeah, but I couldn't hear a word because I didn't have a radio. So he passes up to me. I get in the airplane, and the tower starts lighting me up. Sorry. You know, I have to call him on the phone. I get into the office and grovel and try and explain what happened. And so finally, I'm like, okay, ask the student. I said, what happened? You know, I don't understand.
Yeah.
And he says, well, you know, it's the left runway and the right runway. He says, well, I landed on 19 left. That was the name of the runway back then. Or 19 right, excuse me. Or no, he says 19 left. He thought he landed on. And then when he turned off the runway, he realized that runway was still in front of him. He didn't even know he did it.
He didn't even know. Okay. Yeah.
He was so focused, so tunnel vision. He had no idea. He landed on the wrong runway.
Oh, man.
That was too fun. I mean, I have other stories. People grip on stalls or whatever, trying to shove the airplane over or whatever. Nothing too scary. Nothing where I had to dive.
Well, at least it wasn't. At least he didn't land on the taxiway, I guess. You know, like,
yeah.
Who was it? Harrison Ford.
Yeah, Harrison Ford move. Yeah, he landed on a runway.
Exactly. At least it was a runway, so we'll give him credit for that. All right, cool. So let's see. So flight instruction. So you did that. How did you get to Ameriflight then?
So taught for about 2 years, and I probably ended up with about, I'm trying to remember how much time I had when I left instruction. About 2,000 hours.
Okay, so plenty. Yeah.
Yeah, these days a lot. Back then that was so. Ameriflight, I had some friends that went there, and I was mentioning to you before, but it was a great place to go to get out of the instructor mold, or what do you want to call it, kind of break free of the instruction environment. You know, instructing, you're going out to the practice area back, out to the pattern back. You're not really flying. You're just kind of watching.
Yeah.
It's a good job. Don't get me wrong. I enjoyed it, but it wasn't, you weren't much of a pilot.
Yeah.
So anyways, Ameriflight gave you the opportunity to go out and actually fly the airplane. They would get you show up in the morning, they give you an airplane, say, here's your airplane, here's your cargo. And we need you to fly to these destinations. We don't care how you do it, IFR, VFR. Call us when you're done. It was great. I thought,
wow,
this is what flying's all about.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. You know, but you had to follow your own flight plans and all that kind of stuff, right? You didn't know, you didn't really have a dispatch or anything.
We did have a dispatcher.
Okay.
So you could call them for weather or whatever, assuming you were within radio range, which sometimes you weren't. But you had a dispatcher. So it's kind of like quasi. It was a 135 operate. Yeah.
Okay.
Not quite 21 airline type deal, but it had some structure. And they actually had, for the regularly scheduled routes, they had what they call CAN IFR flight plan. So if you wanted to go fly IFR, you could just call up for your clearance and it was already in there. But if you were doing something that was unusual, you would have to go in and file it yourself, which is good. I mean, basically, you learn how to work the system, every angle, IFR, VFR, filing flight plans, getting weather, all that stuff. It was a good workout.
Yeah.
And you were a single pilot, usually with no autopilot, bad weather, good weather, you name it, you were doing it. So, yeah.
What was the typical length of flight? Would you say an hour, 2 hours, something like that?
Yeah, hour or two. They weren't very long. Sometimes there were multiple stops. Maybe your run is to go up the Owens Valley. So you start out in Burbank, you hop over to like Mojave, Inyo Western, Bishop, and up to Mammoth or out to Tonopah or something. Or maybe another run goes up the Central Valley because of a couple stops or the coast. So
yeah,
they had all kinds of stuff going on, but it was, a lot of times it was more than one stop, which is kind of fun too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you would start out in a little airplane, a Piper Lance, little single engine piston airplane, which wasn't the ideal time. You want multi-time, right? If you're trying to move on, but yeah, I was only in that thing for a couple months. And then I didn't think they have those anymore. I think they got rid of the single engine stuff, but now they moved on to the Piper Chieftain, which was, I felt pretty cool back then. It was the biggest airplane I've ever flown. In turbocharged Chieftain, they call it. That thing was a handful. It had all kinds of levers and cowl flaps and boost pumps and all kinds of crazy stuff going on. And yeah. Then you go back to a Beach 99, which is basically a King Air. It's an unpressurized King Air. And it's also a turbine airplane. So that's, now you're getting turbine time, which is gold.
No problem.
You know, twin engine turbo time, that's what you need if you want to move on. So now I thought it was really cool. Basically a King Air, and I'm ripping around the countryside doing 200 knots and cruise, right? Which sounds pretty cool, flying your 152.
Well, that's pretty fast compared to, we're just talking about it, what, like putting along at like 90, 100 miles per hour.
Exactly. Hey, man, I'm doing 200 knots. It was great. So, yeah, that was cool. And then, so I'm pretty happy at Ameriflight for a while. I thought, you know, I'm getting turbine PIC time. You know, what's my next play? Do I hang out here?
What were your goals at that point in time then? Was it still to move on to the airlines? I mean, that was the ultimate goal, right?
That was always the goal. Yeah. So now I'm getting turbine PIC time. What's my play? What do? I hang out and move on to the regionals. I knew the regionals liked, the majors liked the regional time better than this cargo operations. I don't know. I was making decent money, but was kind of on the fence until my old flight instructor called me one day. He was a captain over at SkyWest, and he said, hey, we're about to hire a ton of people a year. You want a job, basically, he says. Like, well, sure, I'll go check it out. So I went and interviewed, and they had just got this big contract to fly all of United Express out west, and so they needed to hire as many people as they could tonight, or, you know, basically tonight. So anyway, they hired me on the spot. I knew it was going to be a step up in a lot of ways, but I didn't really quite understand until I got there, and I went from a Beach 99, which is a turboprop airplane, to another turboprop airplane, a Brasilia EMB-120. And it was a big leap up. That airplane would do 300 knots, had pressurization, good autopilot, had another guy to fly with. You know, you weren't single pilot anymore. Like I was mentioned before, my big joke is you're sitting there in your nice air-conditioned cockpit, and you push a button, and a flight attendant comes and brings you a Coke. I mean, it was great.
I know. What more could you want, right?
Yeah, I went from loading my own cargo in the middle of the desert heat, you know, and sweating all the way to my destination.
No autopilot.
Yeah, so it was definitely going from blue collar to white collar. It was fun.
Was it better pay? Like, let's say at that time, or was it about the same pay from Ameriflight to SkyWest, or about the same, or a little bit?
I think I was making huge numbers. I think my last, well, I was only at Ameriflight for a year. I think I made 30-something grand that year.
Okay.
This is mid-90s, so it was... Okay. There's enough to live on.
Yeah.
And I think I dropped down to probably 20 my first year at SkyWest. I was making...
So it was actually better than the regionals.
Yeah, Ameriflight was. Yeah. For sure. Nowadays, though, totally different story. I mean, these guys are getting signing bonuses. Their hourly rates are a lot better. It's very competitive. So the regionals are finally paying a halfway decent wage to start. But yeah, back then, you read Top Ramen and scraping goodbye.
Yeah, I think I heard like at the regionals, well, like nowadays you get like something like a $60,000-$80,000 signing bonus or something like that, and then you start at like 60 or something like that, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't know exactly. I think if you add it all up, you first year you could make 60 to 80 something, with your signing bonus and your salary or something like that. But yeah, it's competitive. It's good.
Whole lot better than 20,000, right? You know, at least you could kind of, I mean, you could live off of that, you know, assuming that.
Yeah.
You're good with your cash flow, I guess, expenses.
And to get to that point now is a lot easier. You know, you don't have to go through the 2 years of flight instruction, probably the bonus lap at Ameriflight. You know, you can do a year or two of instruction and boom, right to the right seat regional, and you're probably going to move up pretty quick because things are moving pretty fast. But as in anything, especially this industry, it's all about timing. Timing right now is good. Who knows what it's going to be like tomorrow? I'd have no idea. It can change change an instant, and it does sometimes. But things are really good right now. So,
How did your lifestyle, were you married at that point? Like when you got to SkyWest?
I got married. I'm trying to the year versus my career. So, I was
going to get in trouble.
I know, right? Actually, I remember now. I got married the month after I upgraded to captain at SkyWest.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Now, how was that transition then from, I mean, let's say if you were, I don't know if you were dating between Ameriflight and SkyWest, or, but, you know, just what I'm trying to get at is how was the lifestyle transition going from, let's say, locally? I guess SkyWest, you're still local, right? But you don't really have a lot of overnights.
My wife's very independent, so she's a good airline wife. You know, she, when I go away,
like, thank God he's gone.
Yeah, exactly. Or as another airline buddy of mine said one time, he said, "This household works because I go away." You know, I go on my own. So, anyways, yeah, she's good like that. It wasn't too tough. I think she enjoyed her time away from me as well as with me. So, if you got the right person, it can work. Some people don't do okay with that.
Yeah.
That can obviously be an issue. Beyonce, it doesn't really matter where you're laying over. It's about the time gone. You know, I could be gone for 5 days on the West Coast. It's really no different than 5 days on the East Coast. You're still gone. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But back then it was all West. They were actually SkyWest. They didn't have any East Coast operation, whereas now they fly all over the country, probably more East Coast than West Coast. But
okay.
Yeah, the transition, it was fine. We didn't have kids.
Yeah.
It was actually pretty nice. No complaints.
Yeah.
Actually, even throughout my whole career, I would say the hardest adjustments for me personally, and maybe my wife a little bit, be with commuting. Like, okay. So may or may not be familiar with this, but you, as an airline pilot, you can either live in base or out of base. All right. I fortunately live in base. I'm based in LA and drive to work, which is big. I could live in, say, Phoenix and would have to. They call it commuting. I basically have to fly to work. So I have to go to the airport, get on an airplane, fly to LA to start my trip, and then get going. So it basically eats up quite a bit of time, extra time.
Oh, yeah. I can imagine.
Yeah, on either end of your trip. But you're basically working for a little bit for free. So there were times in my career, like when I first got hired with Delta, a little bit of SkyWest where I was commuting. And that's a little extra stress. It's more time gone. On the pilot, it's a lot more stress. You got to worry about your flights getting there and back. You know, are they open? Can you get on? Do they get you there in time? Are they delayed? You know, it's a lot of extra stress involved in the commuting thing.
Yeah.
So I only did it when I had to. But my goal, when I was looking for a major airline, I only picked airlines that had LA bases because I knew I wanted to live in Southern California and I knew that I did not want to commute.
Yeah.
So it kind of narrowed down a little bit. And I was fortunate enough to get on with one that did have an LA base and eventually got based in LA. So.
How did you get hired on with Delta?
So that's SkyWest. Like I said before, it's kind of a good time to get hired by them. They're growing quickly. I upgraded in 14 months, which is pretty quick.
Okay.
So I was getting Captain Turbo PIC Part 121 regional time. It was about as good as you can get off to the majors. The equivalent today would be like an RJ captain at a regional. Best spot you can be in, besides maybe the military.
Yeah.
So anyways, there I was. Now I'm getting my applications out, and I was fortunate. Well, kind of the typical deal of who you know, right? What you know, who you know. So I was able to meet the right person. I had all the qualifications, but so did hundreds of thousands of
other people.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So my wife's uncle was a Delta captain. He lived out in Park City and had a neighbor that was a former T pilot at Delta. He called me one day and says, "Hey, you need to come out and meet so-and-so." And I was like, okay. So I flew out there and we had dinner, and it was kind of like maybe a little bit of a mock interview. And probably about, I want to say 6 months later after that, maybe a year or something like that, I got a call. And I'm sure that had something to do with it. Basically, he put a stamp of approval on my application, so, you know, streamlined it to the top of the pile in some way, shape, or form. So for other people that are in similar shoes, I mean, today there's all kinds of other to get a kind of a similar deal. They have, I'm trying to think of the right term for it. Conventions you can go to where recruiters from these airlines will go to and you can get FaceTime with them. And you think about it, if you're a business wanting to hire somebody, if you look at a piece of paper versus meeting the person and it makes a big difference. So yeah, any FaceTime get with somebody that's somewhat connected is huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was my story. I just happened to meet the right person. He wrote me a letter of recommendation in some way, shape, or form, and it worked out. So boom, there I was.
Okay, nice, nice. Now, what was the transition like then from, let's say, captain over at SkyWest to, let's say, first officer at Delta?
Well, I didn't even make first officer. I got hired. So,
what did you start off at then?
Yeah, so February 2001, I got hired, and Delta Airlines still had the 727.
Okay,
which was a three-man.
Was it like a flight engineer or something like that?
I was a flight engineer. That's correct.
Yeah. In the back, like working the panels.
Yeah. They call him a plumber and a few other things that I won't say. But anyway, yeah, I was a flight engineer, which was actually kind of cool. So you get hired into this class and they stack you in seniority in some way, shape, or form. Back then it was done by age, and I was one of the youngest guys in the class. So I was one of the most junior. Sometimes they do it by your last 4 digits of your social security. It depends on the airline. Anyway, so here I am, this pretty junior guy, and they go to the class and say, okay, guys, this is what we have available for you. You know, we got 737 here, we got MD-80, and then you bottom guys. Or we have 727 in here. Well, the engineer seat was the least desirable for a couple reasons. One, because you're not flying, right? You're just sitting sideways. Two, because it's actually a really hard class. They called it a hazing class. They basically made sure you knew how to build that airplane. Yeah, they went really deep into the system. Yeah. It was definitely the toughest class, anything that they offered. So long story short, I got engineer, which I was completely happy with. Actually, originally, I got the 737 out of Orlando. Now, remember, I want to live and fly out of L.A. conversation. That was not where I wanted to stay. That's a whole transcon commute. So they said, no, you're going to be 737 Orlando. And I was like, okay, whatever. I'll just, whatever I got to do, and I'll get out of it as soon as I can. And right before I went to class for that 737, they called me and a couple of the junior guys. They said, hey, guys, we're really sorry. We need to put some of you in the 727 and based in Dallas. And I'm like, sweet. I didn't care what I was flying. That just cut my commute in half.
Yeah, that's a lot closer, right?
Yeah. I was fine with that. And it was kind of cool. Even back then, that airplane was really old. Like a flying museum. I knew that when I was flying it, that I'd be able to tell people years from now, hey, I flew the 727 as an engineer. They really? You know?
Yeah.
Like someone that flew the DC-3 back in the 40s or something like that. So, and it was cool. It's three-man crew is kind of fun, something that you'll never see again. They're all gone now. And I actually had a really good time on that airplane. But like I mentioned, I got hired in February of 2001. Fortunately, you know, not long after that, 9/11 happened. The airline industry took a turn for the worst. This would be a segue into the pitfalls of the aviation industry.
Let's talk about that a little bit. So the aviation industry historically has been very volatile. You know, bankruptcies, there's mergers, there's furloughs, losing seniority, you know, pay cuts, you know, yeah, you name it, pretty much everything. This would be good because you got there in 2001. There was a recession right after 2001. And then there was also a recession back in 2008, which we all remember very fondly and vividly. So what was it like just going through? Like, so what were some challenges that you faced, and what did you do to just kind of survive?
Yeah, so 9/11, obviously we all know what happened that day. I woke up that morning. Fortunately, I was not at work. I was at home. A lot of people were over the world, you know, stuck for several days. But I was at home, watched it on TV, didn't really get it to begin with. I didn't really understand, nor did a lot of people, what was about to happen, basically, to our industry.
And then
once it all, after a couple of days, once the pieces all started to come together, and we all started understanding what was going on, I kind of figured, being basically one of the most junior guys in the airline, that I might not have a job real soon.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I think about 3 weeks later, I got a phone call from my chief pilot and said, hey, they announced that they're going to probably furlough people. They'll make a decision here in a week or so. That day came along and got the phone call saying that I was furloughed, you know, or laid off.
Yeah. What month did you get hired in 2001?
February.
Okay. So you had about, I don't know, what, 6 months or something like that. And then there you go. Yeah. Okay.
I think I was gone by November 1st. I think October is my last month. So I was only there 8 months.
Yeah.
Which is ironic because when I got hired, and no dig on these guys, I think they honestly meant what they said. But all people at Delta, they're hiring me. They're, oh, you guys are getting hired at a great time. And I remember this guy that, okay. We just got out of the interview. We just got hired. Me and this other guy, he was from JetBlue. We're standing in the corner going, great, man, we just hit the lottery. This is the last job interview we'll ever have. And sure enough, we literally know, you know, 8 months later, we'd be gone. But I only had a few hundred people below me. You know, everything's done by seniority, right?
Yeah.
All the guys that get hired go underneath, and you move up as they get hired. So I only had a few hundred people. I think the first group of people that went out were the bottom 400. So I was in the first group to go. So here's the problem with furlough. One, you're out of job, right? That's obviously a problem. Second is you don't know how long, and nobody does. The airline doesn't know.
Yeah. So they don't really give you a time, right? They're just like, hey, you know, we got to furlough you, and there's no set date. You're just kind of in limbo, I guess.
They were in outright panic mode. All right. They're just trying to survive this way. They were already losing money when I got hired. Yeah. 9/11 happened. Now nobody's flying. And I can imagine the boardroom meetings are chaotic. And they're just like, what do we do? So, yeah, I'm just a number. And I got it. It's a business. You know, I didn't take it personally. I understand that that's how it works. So off I went. But the problem is, yeah, like we were saying, you just don't know how long. So if they could have said, hey, Seth, you're going to be gone for 5 years or a year or whatever, I could plan accordingly. You know, if it's going to be a few months, maybe I go flip burgers for a few months and then I come back and I'm good. If it's going to be 10 years. Maybe I get another career. Yeah. I don't know. And that was the problem. Initially, you just don't know. I mean, initially it was, hey, nobody's flying because they're scared of terrorists. And then it was, oh, you know, there's a war in Iraq. And then it just kind of snowballed. There was SARS and there was a fuel spike and there was bankruptcies and all kinds of stuff. It kind of...
It's like one after another.
One after another. Yeah, yeah. And so I think about 3-4 years. I ended up being out for almost 5 years for a look.
Okay.
After, yeah.
5 years, did you say? Wow. Okay. Yeah. What did you do during that time?
What did I do? So I only had, I can't remember how much notice they gave me, a couple of weeks or something like that. Not long, right?
Yeah.
And I kind of, in a roundabout way, got kicked out of aviation. So the military guys, they all went back to the military because the military is ramping up. They're about to start a war. So they all had jobs. Civilian guys, they, Delta, as they kicked me out the door, they said, oh, by the way, if we get a letter of resignation from you, you will be erased from the seniority list. Okay. So what that means is, I had recall rights, so I still had a name on the seniority list. Mm-hmm. Of course, the active guys were up here, and I'm over here. But as they started needing pilots, they're going to go down that list and call you back eventually. Well, they said if we get a letter of resignation from you, you will be erased from that list.
Yeah.
So the way it worked was I had corporate jobs that I could have done, which would have been pretty good gigs. But they all wanted me to sign a letter of resignation from Delta because they didn't want to pay to train me and then have me
and then have you like just bounce, afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. So I get it. I understand where they're coming from. Even I told him, hey, look, I'll be around for at least 2 years. You know, I mean, I'm not going anywhere. Yeah, Delta's not going to call me back anytime soon. So, but I couldn't find that letter. I mean, it'd be like resigning your right to get back to the major leagues if you're a baseball player or something like that. You know, yeah. I mean, you just it'd be stupid to do.
Yeah, that's something you worked for, you know, all these years. And it'd be kind of foolish, I think, to just kind of give up on that.
Very foolish. So, anyways, that wasn't going to happen. Anyway, so what did I do? I had one of my multiple jobs I had when I was in college trying to pay for flying was remodeling houses. I have some uncles and friends that have a construction company. And, you know, during that time, I remember the early 2000s, construction was booming and they needed people to help from work. So I went out and remodel houses for almost 5 years, basically.
Okay.
And I tried, that was a good, hey, I got a job, you know, a decent paycheck. Let's keep things going. And then while I was out, I was like, okay, I really don't want to rely on flying.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like to diversify. So
yeah,
I had all these visits of maybe starting a business. I was a loan officer for all of 3 days. You know, the mortgage boom was happening.
For all of 3 days. Nice.
I had never had an office job before and didn't really know what I was in for. And
yeah,
by the third morning, I walked in and looked around.
Was it just cold calling?
No. What else did I do? I think I started doing appraisals. I kind of dabbled around, but at the end of the day, I went, I think it was August of 2006, Delta, they were in the middle of bankruptcy, but they had a plan. They needed pilots to come back and fly for them. So they called me back and I was like, yeah, I'll go. Some people held out. They wanted to make sure that Delta can be stable. And I really had nothing to lose. So I'm like, yeah, I'll come back. And once I got back there, I realized that for me anyways, you know, everybody's got their own story. It's just better. It was easier to focus on and maximize my earnings at Delta rather than trying to diversify and run a business on the side or, you know, have some other side gig.
Yeah.
Less complication in my life. I had started a family. And
yeah.
So I ended up not having a side gig. A lot of people do. You know, a lot of people have enough free time to run a business or whatever. And some people it works out for. Some people wish they didn't do it.
See that a good amount too. Pilots it's kind of all over the place. I mean, you see pilots with all sorts of stuff, you know, as far as like side gigs and side income and stuff like that, which it's healthy if that's something that you enjoy and it's not something that just stresses you out.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with just being a pilot. That's a great career. It's a great job.
Yeah. If you hustle at this job, you can do just as well as part of your side gig, depending what that side gig is or whatever. But so anyway, I just decided to keep it simple and for better or for worse, I'm just a pilot.
Yeah. Just a pilot, right? Now, you mentioned, so if you hustle, so I think that's a good point that we can talk about too. If you hustle, you can make some good money too. Not that you guys don't make good money, but you can make even better money. So tell us about that. You know, how do you make extra income as a first officer, as a captain at a major?
Yeah, you know, every airline has their own set of work rules and the way they pay and how they pay overtime, but I'll kind of break it down for Delta. And it's pretty similar to other airlines. There's two types of pilot. There's a reserve pilot and a line holder. A reserve guy basically has a set of days that he's on call and kind of at the company's beck and call, you know, whenever they need you, you go. A line holder has a set schedule. Every month you get, you know, what trips you have, what days you're going to start, what days you're going to finish, where you're going to go, what legs, what layover, and all that stuff. So a lot more control over your life.
Now, is that based on seniority?
It's all based on seniority. Now, that's not to say that senior guys don't bid reserve. Sometimes they do. Okay. You know, if you're in a category that's overstaffed and you don't want to fly and you're senior, maybe you bid reserve and you just don't fly that month. You still get a paycheck, you know, maybe not as much as if you're a line holder, but you're going to sit at home and get paid. So sometimes reserve goes senior, sometimes it goes junior. But anyways, as a reserve guy, less options for maximizing your pay usually, although there are little tricks you can do here and there. But as a line guy, generally, it's a little easier to manipulate your schedule and do things. So, you know, it gets kind of complicated. There's always little, always kind of schemes that people come up with.
creative ways.
Yes. Creative flying. Long story short, is the key is would be to pick up overtime. In our airline, it pays double time. So if you're a line holder and you pick up a trip on your days off as what we would call it, you know, an overtime trip, or they call it a green slip or whatever, it's an overtime trip, they pay it double time. Fly 2 days, you get paid for four, basically. And if you can figure out how to maximize those type of trips, you definitely augment your pay quite a bit. And there's other tricks.
How easy is it to snag one of those overtime slots or flights, I guess? Like, I mean, are they readily available? I mean, are they pretty easy?
It depends on a lot of things. It depends on your category. Sometimes your category is well-staffed. They're not very available. Sometimes it's short and they're giving them out like candy. Depends on the time of year, summertime. The airline staffs for summertime, but not quite enough to cover summertime. They staff a little below summertime, assuming that pilots will pick up overtime to cover that little extra gap. So that in the slow months, they don't have a big surplus. So, yeah, usually summertime or maybe holidays coming up like Christmas, something like that, they're at least short and you can snag overtime trips that way too. In our case, in a lot of airlines' case, it's based on seniority. So they'll basically start at the top of the list and say, hey, you want this trip? No. And it comes down the list and eventually somebody will grab it. Yeah. So seniority, staffing, and the time of year are the three key ingredients to snagging some overtime.
Yeah. Okay. So anything else besides overtime? As far as just kind of making some extra income, there's a maximum amount of hours, right, that you guys can fly, like in a single year?
Yeah.
How easy, or actually, what is the maximum?
In a year, I believe it's 1,000 hours. Never hit that amount. Yeah. So that's kind of another, so it's 1,000 hours, not of pay, but 1,000 hours of flight time.
Yeah.
And
are there guys and gals that hit 1,000 hours in a year?
Yeah, there probably are. But again, a way to avoid that limit, I mean, that's a lot of flying, but to avoid that limit would be bid trips that have credit. So for example, I'll use this trip I used to fly on my old airplane, the Guatemala trip. So it'd be a red eye down to Guatemala, you lay over for 24 hours and you fly back the next day. So you were gone 2.5 days, you only flew 2 legs, but you got paid for basically 3 whole days. Okay, just the way the time and the contract works. And so basically what I'm getting at is a lot of credit in there. You maybe only flew 10 hours, but you got paid for, say, 15.
Okay.
So that 10 hours is what counts towards 1,000 hours, not the 15. The goal would be to fly as little as possible to get paid as much as possible.
Yeah.
Get trips that have as much credit as possible. One way to stay out of that 1,000 hour limit. Deadheading is another way. I used to have trips that would start with a deadhead from L.A. all the way to Tokyo.
Oh, wow. Okay.
12 hours of pay. I'm not flying. I'm just sitting back, you know, watching movies.
Yeah, that's not bad, right? That's not bad. Except you're stuck on a flight for 12 hours. But hey, getting paid.
Hey, you're first class. I was getting paid. I was in first class watching movies. It wasn't, you know.
So your experience, let's say through 2001, you know, you were out for 5 years. So what was that? 2006, right? You said when you got back in. So 2008 comes along. Were you first officer at that time in 2008?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was like first officer. Yeah, that's a good question. So for most of the world, 2008 was a pretty bad time, right? Mm-hmm. Especially you're in the financial planning business. So that was probably a horrible time.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The only good news about 9/11 is that it forced airlines to get lean and mean prior to the big recession. So when it came along, yeah, they got hurt. You know, they were definitely struggling, but not like they would have been had they not gone through 9/11.
Yeah.
They were already back pretty lean. Delta didn't furlough. They were close. They thought about it, but they held on to a little bit of excess. It's expensive to furlough and then call back and retrain. So they thought, you know, we're going to hold on and try and ride it out. I think United furloughed and maybe a couple, I think UPS, maybe a couple airlines furloughed. But for the most part, Delta and some of the airlines were already lean and mean. So it wasn't as big a trauma as it was for everybody else, basically. Yeah. And, you know, I kind of felt sorry for people, like all these people in other industries losing their jobs, their houses and stuff. And, but in the back of my head, I'm like, hey, this is why I
went through. Yeah, you guys already went through this. Yeah. I mean, it would be horrible if you got furloughed for, you know, however long after those 5 years, you know, you finally got back, you worked 2 years and then like you're back out another 2-3 years or something like that.
So, yeah. And that happened. I had some friends that went to United at the same time that I went to Delta, and just by luck, I got furloughed once. They got furloughed twice.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would have been rough.
Yeah.
Really rough. So I'd like to think that was an exceptionally dark period, that 10 years. I'm not going to say the industry is immune to anything like that again, but I will say that it's way better position now than it was back then.
So it's a lot healthier as far as, you know, the airlines and just the industry in general is concerned.
But I was still the guy, my new guys that are flying was just getting hired. Because obviously if you're at the bottom of the scenario, this furlough and a downturn or high up on your mind.
I mean, that's, you know, pretty scary. Like you know, that's if you're just relying on your family or just relying on the pay. I mean, you get furloughed. Well, hey, like you said, you don't have a return time.
Those guys just gave up good jobs either in the military or the regionals. Mm-hmm. You know, decent pay. They gave those up. They can't, for the most part, can't go back to them. And they're rolling the dice on this airline. It's a bit of a risk. But I tell guys now that things are a lot different than when I got hired. When I got hired in 2001, Delta was already losing money.
Yeah.
They were I remember walking around, watching the operation, thinking, these jets sit around a lot. We would fly one leg, say Dallas, you know, Amarillo or something like that. And we'd sit for 2 or 3 hours with the jet.
Oh, really?
You know? Yeah. And then go fly. Yeah. Nowadays, these airplanes.
So it's like turning around all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. They've squeezed a lot more efficiency. They figured out how to squeeze a lot more efficiency out of these airlines. And that's just one small example. But you contrast that with finances of today, Delta's making quite a pretty healthy profit margin. It would take a pretty big financial setback for them to eat that up and start losing money again. So a lot bigger cushion now than when I got hired.
Okay. Now, as far as pay and benefits and things like that, so in 2008, did they cut back on any of that stuff for you guys? So like, let's say the matching or, you know, the amount that they put into your retirement, you know, so on and so forth.
Right. So when I got hired, they had a defined benefit plan, pension.
The pension,
And I remember them explaining it to me, thinking, okay, that's great. The only problem is Delta has to remain solvent my entire lifetime. I was like 30 years old, you know, so this thing's got to be solvent for another 50 or whatever years. It's an airline. What are the odds of that? Well, apparently not very good. A few years later, they were bankrupt. And so, in bankruptcy and leading up to bankruptcy, they took some pretty big pay cuts. But ultimately, what it ended up being for Delta and most of the other airlines was we took about a 43% pay cut.
Yeah.
The defined benefit went away. Did switch to a defined contribution. So now, for example, they'll take whatever I make and multiply it times 16% and stick it right in my 401k.
You don't even have to contribute, right?
Not a penny.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily like a match, but it's just a straight 16% contribution into it.
Exactly. Yeah. So the upside of that is it's all my name, you know, whereas before defined benefit, the company has to remain solvent for it to get paid out. It's a promise, basically, whereas the defined contribution, Delta could go out tomorrow and that my bank account doesn't change.
Yeah.
So that's the side of that. The downside is it has to be invested properly. You don't really know. There's no set number that you can count on when you actually go to retire. You know, defined benefit, there's a formula, a calculation. You go, okay, I know exactly what I'm going to be taking when I walk out the door. Whereas your 401k, who knows? You probably know more.
Yeah, I mean, it's like everyone's always searching for like the number, right? Like what's the secret number to retirement? Like how much do you need for retirement and stuff like that? And the answer is always like, it depends, right? It depends on the lifestyle. Yeah. It depends on your medical expenses when you get older. It depends on whether you need to get into long-term care, like all that kind of stuff. But you have to plan for it, right? And especially airline pilots. You guys have a whole sorts of stuff that other industries don't even have to deal with. We talked about some of it, the furloughs, the bankruptcies. I mean, some industries deal with it, but you guys are a little bit more volatile, hopefully. And, you know, you guys are on the right foot now. But medicals, you know, FAA medicals, you know, you have your first class medical that you have to pass. And, well, hey, what if something happens and you don't have a medical anymore? FAA retirement age of 65. You know, in some other industries, it's like, okay, well, you know, maybe I could work a few more years, make a little bit more money, put some more money away, and then retire. You guys don't really have that option there.
Nope, not yet. Matter of fact, it's funny you mentioned, I went and got my FAA medical yesterday. And yeah, it's one of the problems with the industry. You know, you're exposed to pitfalls like getting a diabetes or some kind of medical condition that prevents you from flying, or airline going out of business. I think of other things. Yeah, that is one part. It's a very narrow field. So say that tomorrow, for whatever reason, I couldn't fly.
Yeah.
What do I do? I mean,
I guess you could fly. I mean, if you could do like a second class medical, I guess, if you could pass that, right? Then at least you could do other stuff in the field.
Yeah. Depends on the issue. There are other things that you can be an instructor maybe of some sort.
Yeah.
You know, there
That's
are
not the same for sure.
Yeah. But it just depends on how, you know, what's your situation, how bad is it?
Yeah.
Definitely a little worrisome. Now, there is insurance. You know, we have pretty good short-term disability insurance. That's only good for, I forget, a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
You do drop. After that, you go to long-term, which basically pays you 50%, I believe, until your retirement age, so 65. So you will have something.
Yeah.
Which helps. But it's still definitely in the back of our minds, you know, what happens if I can't fly anymore?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So now you fly, let's say you flew 727s, right, at Delta. And so what did you fly after the 727?
Yeah, I got furloughed, came back to the MD-80.
Oh, okay, the MD-80.
Yeah, stretch DC-9. And that, theoretically, that basically was the first jet that I ever flew. The engineers said you weren't really flying, you're kind of watching your guys fly.
Yeah.
So yeah, flew MD-80. So I came back, and I got the MD-80 in Salt Lake, which is, yeah, okay, still commuting, but not too bad.
Okay.
Pretty easy commute. While I'm in training, they come out with and they call it an advanced entitlement, where they post openings for other positions.
Okay.
And I got awarded the 767 in LA.
Oh, okay.
And I made it, right? Yeah. Now I'm back in LA. I'm a great airplane. But I still had to finish training on the 88, or the MD-80, and then go to the line. I flew for 3 months on that airplane. Then went right back to training. And then been in LA ever since. It was worth it.
Yeah.
I'm not complaining.
Yeah.
So yeah, I flew the 767. It's actually what they call a dual type certificate. Most airplanes, you fly more or less one airplane. Boeing built the 757 and the 767. They made the cockpit similar enough to where the FAA said, okay, we'll give you a license to fly both of them.
Yeah.
I got to fly both of those airplanes for quite a few years.
So you flew the 75 and the 76 then?
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. So was it more, I guess, did you just do like a mix of like domestic and long hauls and short hauls and long hauls?
Yeah. So that ended up being probably one of the coolest categories in the airline industry.
Yeah, because you have both, right? Basically, both types, you know, you have all sorts of routes.
Yeah. If you wanted to go fly long haul international and go see the world, you go fly the 76. We had trips that went all over Asia, out to Europe, out there, right? You got tired of that, you want to do short off domestic, you go fly the 75 for a little bit.
Yeah.
So you can really mix it up. You never got tired of
the
same routine. And we had so many destinations and so many different varieties. And they have sports charters, fleet of airplanes.
Oh, the sports charters.
The NBA.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah, so if you want to fly sports teams around, you got that. A lot of variety on that airplane. It was great. And I did that for 10 years.
I guess, what's your preference then? I guess, what are the advantages and disadvantages of short haul versus long haul in your experience?
Yeah. So for me, coming from the regionals, I loved the long haul initially because it was new. I'd never been to a lot of these places. So it was kind of like a paid vacation. I was going out to explore somewhere new. And the type of flying was new. So I was learning how to fly these overwater transoceanic flights. And I had a blast doing that for a long time. I'm not going to lie to you. Time zone changes like that are tough.
Yeah. I'm sure it got old real quick, right? You're just tired.
State of fatigue. Yeah. It was fun, but it was fatiguing. And so I did that off and on for basically about 10 years.
Okay.
But I was able to mix it up with domestic stuff too. So it wasn't all international. And then few years ago, I upgraded to the 717, which is kind of an oddball. I mean,
it's like the short haul, like regional jet, right? Basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. We call it the heavy RJ, basically. Okay. It's just a little short hops. And it was, again, based out of LA. Most of my trips were based out of Orange County, which is where I live. It was awesome. I was just doing short hop domestic stuff. And so basically the opposite of the long haul stuff, but it was great. I had seen the world. I had done the long haul stuff. I was kind of over it. And it was nice to come back to my roots, just flying this regional pipeline.
Yeah.
Had a blast. So in answer to your question, it kind of depends on what you're in the mood for, you know? Like for a while there, the international was worth that. I was loving it. But I kind of got burned out and I was ready to come back and fly some domestic. And I'm enjoying it now.
Yeah.
Did the 717 for a couple of years and then they unfortunately removed it from LA. So I had to find a new, either I followed the airplane out back east or I had to find a new home.
And
I ended up in the 737. Yeah, been on that for a couple months now. It's a domestic airplane as well, for the most part. It just has a bigger range. It'll fly up to Alaska, Hawaii, go down to Central America, Caribbean. Yeah, but still mostly domestic.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So now, out of all those planes that we just talked about, you know, the 71, the 72, 75, 76, and the 80, 73, what would you think your aircraft out of all those?
Yeah. Hands down, it's the 75.
The 75? Why the 75?
Well, it looks good. It's a really sexy looking airplane, right? Do you know what it looks like?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's like a pencil, right? Basically. Well, that's long, but it looks good.
Yeah, it's a good looking jet. It flies really nice. Our CEO called it one time God's airplane because it basically does everything.
Yeah.
You can take off out of Orange County, which is a really short runway, fully loaded and fly all the way across the country. You know, there's not too many airplanes that can do that with that big of a load.
Mm-hmm.
You can do anything you want in that airplane. You can go fly over the water. Fly, I think the range is up to 7, maybe 8 hours. So they'll do European legs out of New York.
Yeah.
It'll do short hop domestic. It'll, you know, long runway, short runways, you name it, it'll do it. And it'll, from a pilot's point of view, it's really nice because first of all, it's a comfortable cockpit. It's pretty sizable.
Yeah.
All one level of technology. So a lot of these airplanes, like my current airplane, 737, I call it a collage of technology. You know, if the overhead panel is literally from the Apollo space. It hasn't changed. But then it's got more nice glass displays in front of you, and I have a HUD to look at. So it's got some modern stuff too. It's kind of a collage. 75, it's one level. The whole thing was designed once, and it was all integrated nicely. It just works really well. Performance-wise, I mean, it's awesome. It'll do anything you ask it to.
Yeah.
It doesn't complain. Some airplanes that, you know, there's airplanes that have been stretched too much, like the 737-900 that I fly now. It's an extremely long 737, and it really doesn't like to climb, needs nice long runways to take off. It'll do the job, but it's just it's not a great performing air versus 7.5. It'll, short runway, no problem.
Oh, yeah.
You want to climb up and go high, no problem.
Yeah. Nice.
It just flew nice. It's a fun airplane to hand fly.
Yeah. Now, what's your least favorite aircraft?
My least favorite aircraft. I got to go with the crowd on this one. Most people at Delta would say the MD-80. And I have to go along with the crowd on that one. It's, there's a saying that how's it go? It says Boeing builds airplanes and McDonnell Douglas builds character.
That's a good way to put it, right? That,
yeah. And what they mean by that, the engineers at Boeing really went out of their way to design an airplane for the pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And McDonnell Douglas, it's almost like it was a challenge to see if they could do something a certain way, not regardless of what the pilots thought about it. There's just things in that airplane that are really unusual and quirky, and that without being a hard to show you. But once, like any airplane, once you learned it, it worked fine. It was a very durable airplane.
No.
It had a lot of interesting quirks, put it that way. Yeah.
So what's next for you then? You're currently a captain over at Delta. You're flying the 737. You know, obviously you'll stay on Delta, but are you going to stay in the 737? Are you going to move on to another type rating? And you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know, what are your plans after retire? I mean, you're still young, but you know, I don't know if you've thought about a career after the airlines, but what are your plans or what's next for you?
Yeah. You know, I'm pretty happy where I'm at right now. I unless something better came along, I'm going to stay put for a little bit. When you change airplanes, you basically go through about a month and a half of training, which I really don't want to do anytime soon. I've done that quite a bit so far.
Yeah.
So I'm going to stay put. The airplane, the 737 is decent jet. It does have some good layovers, good routes. So I'm going to hang tight and enjoy my seniority on the airplane. Maybe go to the Airbus someday. I've never flown an Airbus yet.
Yeah.
I'd like to try that sometime. it's a very different way of doing things. So I wouldn't mind trying that before my career is over. But yeah, as far as retirement goes, boy, I don't know. You know, I'm kind of one of those guys that I don't really want to retire. I don't want to sit around the house all day and figure out, you know, go golf or whatever. And I wouldn't mind having some sort of a job or something to get out of the house.
Would you still try to fly in maybe like some GA flying or something like that in retirement?
I would definitely, yeah. I mean, at this point, I got a ways to go, but at this point, I could see maybe doing something like that. Yeah, I like flying. So yeah. I could see definitely something outside of the airlines. Yeah, I don't want to do nothing.
Yeah. Have you ever flown the Airbuses, like in simulators or anything like that? I mean, but you're aware of how.
No.
No, not really. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you the eternal, what you thought of the eternal debate, Boeing or Airbus?
Boeing or Airbus, yeah. Boy, well, I'm not a good candidate for that discussion. I've never flown an Airbus.
Yeah.
I know a fair amount about them. I will say this, Airbuses are very comfortable, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, see, the passengers, the tube is bigger than A320 is bigger than a 737 tube. So, it's a much more comfortable tube. It's a newer jet. So, they have kind of a leg up in level of technology. Yeah, the cockpits are much more comfortable than the A320 cockpits, right? Much more comfortable than the 737.
Yeah.
So, on the narrow body side, I think Airbus wins. Sure. Yeah, 73, it's a good jet. It does the job. It's reliable, but it's time for a remodel. On the wide body side, I don't know. I heard the 78's really nice.
Yeah.
I've never flown that. 777 I know is really nice. And the Airbus 320s and 350s are great too. So I don't know. It's probably a tie, maybe down to preference on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. But not having flown them, I can't tell you definitively. I would like to try a side stick though. I think that'd be cool.
Yeah, that would be interesting. It's different, right? You know, it'd be different from a yoke, and then you have the fly-by-wire and all that kind of just different technologies, I guess. But
yeah, very different way of doing things.
Yeah.
The guys that I know that fly them, have been flying for a while, the Airbuses, they really like them. It does, I think the one drawback to Airbus is it does take the pilot out of the loop a little bit.
Yeah.
It's designed to be very simple and, you know, require maybe a little bit less skill level to fly. But, and for the most part, I think that's a good thing until it's not. It's that automation starts to go haywire, then some pilots are lulled into a sense of lower state.
Well, it makes sense,
I guess you could say.
I mean, you don't do something for a prolonged period of time and you just tend to, you know, it's not like you want to, but you know, you just tend to not become as proficient, I guess, you know, at it.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a highly automated blade, and that automation goes away, I think, can cause problems sometimes. But
yeah.
Other than that, it seems like it's an airplane. Very comfortable.
Yeah. Speaking of different like aircraft types, as we're wrapping up over here, I believe you guys get paid, right, differently, or there's different pay scales for different aircraft types? Yeah, is that how it works?
Yeah. So, again, this varies widely by airline. UPS being one extreme, they have captain and co-pilot pay. So it doesn't matter what airplane you're flying. It's the same pay rate for captains and same pay rate for co-pilot.
Mm-hmm.
The other extreme would be my airline, Delta. We've got different pay rates for the 717, the 737, Airbus, 767, 57. Some of them are banded. I think 777 and the 747 when we had it paid the same. But there's definitely more or less the bigger the airplane, the more you get paid.
Yeah.
The general way it works. And then the other big pay gap would be between a co-pilot and a captain.
Yeah.
Generally about 30% pay increase when you go from the right seat to the left seat. But I will say this, just because you upgrade doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get a 30% pay bump. Because what can happen, like we were mentioned before with the hustling, right?
Mm-hmm.
As a senior co-pilot, you can actually do pretty well as a co-pilot, almost as good as a captain if you're hustling.
Yeah.
Because when you go to captain, you're going to be on the junior side of the scale.
Yeah.
You get as much of that overtime.
Yeah. And then you just kind of have to work your way up or work your way back up again.
Yeah, just because your hourly pay rate went up 30% doesn't mean your paycheck necessarily is going to go up that much, because you may be getting paid less hours per month as a captain than you were as a co-pilot.
Yeah, yeah, definitely makes sense.
Yeah, there's a lot of little things coming into play, but I remember me as a co-pilot, much easier to pick up overtime. And generally speaking, it's much more available for the co-pilots because they keep them a little thinner staff because they're cheaper versus the captain. So my hourly, I would average probably over an hour, over 100 hours of pay a month.
Okay.
Not that I was flying that much, but that's how many hours I would get paid versus captain. I'm probably under that now. So
yeah,
even though my pay rate's more as a captain, I'm not getting paid. You know, it wasn't a 30% pay bump is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Necessarily.
Yeah.
It depends. You're not hustling as a co-pilot. You're not hustling as a captain, then maybe it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, yeah, that totally makes sense. Now, any interesting or funny just aviation stories in general that you like to share with us?
Oh, boy.
I'm sure you got lots of those.
Interesting or, I mean, yeah, I'm just trying to think. They usually jar from my head when something else pops up that's similar. Yeah, I'm trying to think, like, what's something unusual that happens flying? Jeez, boy, that's a good question.
Or any ridiculous passenger stories?
Ridiculous passengers? I've actually been pretty lucky with passengers. I haven't had to throw anybody off. Yeah, I've had some drunks here and there, but yeah, they all kind of settle themselves out, you know. I've had a lot of medical issues.
Okay.
People, you know, getting sick on flights. A lot more on the long haul flights.
Okay.
Those were just, you know, people are on the airplane a long time, get dehydrated, maybe low blood sugar, they pass out. Or
yeah,
there's some kind of other terminal stress brings out some medical issues they have.
Yeah. Or how about this? We'll make it easy on you. Any major equipment malfunctions then while in flight?
All right. Here, listen to this. That's me knocking on wood. I've never had an engine failure.
Oh, okay. Good. Good.
Yeah, I can't believe it. I know. I've been pretty fortunate.
But oh, I mean, they're reliable, right? Yeah, you can. I mean, that's you got yeah, two
yeah,
engines
the only
anyways.
Time I ever had an engine, I've only had one engine stop turn. It was a little aerobatic airplane. My brother and I were out flying aerobatics here one day, and we were doing a spin. And you have the power to idle when you're spinning.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the spin, the prop just stopped. And so I'm actually right over my landing field. I'm looking straight down at it, about 5,000 feet in the air. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to try something. So I kick it out of the spin. I put it in a nosedive. And the guy's like 130 knots, thinking that prop's going to start turning, right?
Yeah. Fan. No, nothing.
Didn't move. I kicked it out of the dive, hit the starter, boom, started right back up. Huh. And my poor brother, he's back there the whole time, right? He didn't say a word. Finally, the engine starts back up. We start climbing. He's like, that wasn't supposed to happen.
Like, was that like, normal? Oh, that's hilarious.
I missed an engine failure by one leg. I flew an airplane back from Japan to Honolulu, and the engine was kind of acting up on that leg. And so we got to Honolulu and wrote it all up, made it look at it, and they couldn't really find anything wrong with it. So they signed it off, and the next guy took it. I happened to be on that plane. I was deadheading back.
Oh, really?
Sitting there in first class, I just took off and also got really quiet. I'm like, uh-oh, I know what that is.
Yeah.
And, so anyways, they came around and landed, the engine quit. But yeah, got that bullet by one leg.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been pretty fortunate. You know, I've had minor stuff here and there, but nothing,
yeah,
nothing too major.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Let's, knock on wood. Yeah, let's hope it, hope it doesn't happen.
If it ever happens, I'll call you up. We'll do another podcast.
Yeah, we'll talk all about it. All right, so let's say last question. So let's just say first officer comes up to you and says, based on your experience, what is your best financial advice for me? Yeah, what would you tell him or her?
Well, there's a classic, stay with one wife, right? That's always the typical pilot joke. Let's see. That's financial advice. Get a financial advisor. Right? Because pilots
are, I like that. Yeah.
Pilots are historically pretty bad stock pickers.
Well, yeah, it's about stock picking or investment picking, let's just say, and then also just basic. Yeah. We went over this. Just basic financial planning, right? There's a lot of variables that can come up in the future, and you gotta make sure you're prepared no matter what happens.
I think pilots fall into the pitfall. We do this job that's somewhat challenging, somewhat dangerous, and we succeed 99.999% of the time, right? So we think we're pretty cool sometimes. And you look at finance, you go, oh, that's easy, I can do that. Or whatever it is, you name the outside extracurricular activity, and we have this overinflated sense that we can succeed all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's good to have a little ego check and realize, hey, to see fly airplane doesn't mean you can do whatever. And so, yeah, get some advice, get some help. Live within your means. Me personally, real estate's been good to me. Mm-hmm. A lot of that's just due to timing. Better lucky than good type scenario. But I think real estate's a good place to put some money.
Definitely.
Especially if you want to. Yeah. Yeah, live within your means, I think, is
I think that's a big one. Yeah, I think that's a really big one. I mean, it sounds simple.
Yeah.
Just way too many people just live outside their means. Your income has to be more than your expenses. Simple as that. Plus a little bit for savings and whatnot, but I mean, as long as you can do that, then that's
Yeah, you sleep a lot.
Your future self will thank you. Let's put it that way.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, cool. Sure. Well, hey, yeah. Seth, it was great talking to you. Thanks for coming on to the podcast, and thanks for sharing your experiences. You know, it's it was wonderful just kind of learning all about you, learning all about, you know, what you have to say and everything. So, yeah, thank you.
Yeah. All right. Nice to have you. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Level Playing Field podcast. Make sure to visit our website, thelevelplayingfield.com, where you can subscribe to the show so you'll never miss a single episode. If you found value in this episode, please rate us on iTunes or simply tell a friend about us. Join us again next week for a chance to propel your knowledge to new heights.